5:05 was Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after this latest world news headline.
I'm Steve Norman reporting. Western efforts to stem the flow of foreign fighters to the conflicts in Syria and Iraq are starting to have an impact, but would-be militants are still finding their way to the battlefront. A U.S. intelligence official told VOA, on condition of anonymity, that more than 34,000 foreign fighters from at least 120 countries have now gone to fight in Iraq and Syria. Of those, at least 6,000 are Westerners. French police shoot and kill a man trying to attack a police station, and officials are saying the man was carrying a knife and appeared to be wearing an explosives vest, although it later turned out to be fake. Incident occurred on the first anniversary of the terrorist assault on the offices of the Charlie Hebdo magazine. Officials also say the man was thought to have shouted the Islamic phrase Allahu Akbar before police shot him to death. The Paris prosecutor identified the man as Salah Ali. South Korea said Thursday it will halt aid to North Korea and limit inter-Korean exchanges. The measures are being taken in response to North Korea's nuclear test this week. Earlier in the week, a South Korean Unification Ministry official said the government will also limit South Koreans' entry to the Kaesong Industrial Complex. According to officials and local news reports, a truck bomb in western Libya has killed at least 50 people, wounded dozens more. The attack came at a police training center. Bomb exploded as hundreds of recruits gathered at the facility in the town of Zlitan, and there had been no claim of responsibility for the attack. This is VOA News. Israeli soldiers shot and killed three Palestinians who tried to stab them outside a Jewish settlement near Jerusalem. Settlement had been one of the focal points of Palestinian violence, now in its fourth month. Also on Thursday, Israeli security forces announced last month the arrest of six Hamas terrorists who were planning to kidnap and murder an Israeli citizen. Officials say the Hamas terror cell was planning to use the Israeli hostage as a bargaining chip for freedom for Palestinian prisoners. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says implementation of the Iran nuclear agreement would be just days away if all goes well. He commented at a Thursday briefing in which he highlighted U.S. foreign policy progress over the past year. Kerry said he'd spoken to his counterparts in Iran and Saudi Arabia and that both agreed that they would be able to allow the current rift to hamper talks with Syria.
And all indications are, in both my conversation with Foreign Minister Adel al-Jaber of Saudi Arabia and my conversation with Foreign Minister Javad Zarif, they both assured us and others that the differences between them at this moment, expressed very publicly, will not interfere with their willingness to work cooperatively in an effort to resolve Syria.
That's John Kerry, the U.S. Secretary of State. Bahrain says it arrested members of a terrorist cell plotting to set off explosives across the country. The government described the cell as an armed wing of the Shiite fringe opposition group Al-Hawab, which Bahrain is saying had ties to Iran and Hezbollah. The arrest came amid ongoing protests in Bahrain and across the region over Saudi Arabia's execution of a prominent Shiite cleric. Polish President Andrzej Duda has signed a new law giving the country's government control over the state media, and aides said the president wants state media to be impartial, objective, and reliable. European Commission Vice President Frans Timmermans says it's appropriate for the EU to take up the issue.
Protecting the rule of law and human rights in those member states is a collective responsibility, not just of the member states, but of the Union as a whole. And that is enshrined in our treaties, that is enshrined in all the obligations pertaining to human rights, and I think it is only just that the Commission would take that up with every single member state if so warranted.
European Commission First Vice President Frans Timmermans. You can get more news by going to our website, and you can find us at voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. James Bate in Washington. Today is Friday, January 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan rebels and the government Thursday signed a power-sharing deal that moves the country one more step closer to peace.
We have divided the ministries. The government of the Republic of South Sudan will take 16 ministries. The SPLM, SPLA in opposition will take 16. The former detainees will take 2. And the other political parties will take 2. So this is actually a serious breakthrough.
Ezekiel Logat-Kuof is the Secretary for Foreign Affairs for the SPLM, SPLA in opposition. A Kenya bus attack victim pleads for peaceful coexistence. Libya's Islamic State radio calls for unity as the country suffers its deadliest bombing since the fall of Gaddafi. And a Ugandan inter-religious council demands an inquiry into alleged voter list tampering.
We are calling upon the police and the Electoral Commission to investigate those allegations thoroughly, to ensure that we have a credible election.
Joshua Kitakule is General Secretary of the Inter-Religious Council of Uganda. Doctors Without Borders starts a trauma surgery unit in Nigeria's troubled Maiduguri. And more and more Zimbabweans are turning to sports betting to earn extra money in the face of economic hardships. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our Listener of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Rebels, lawyers to former South Sudan Vice President Riek Machar, are hailing a power-sharing deal with the government as a serious breakthrough and a win-win situation, one that brings their country one more step closer to peace. The agreement signed Thursday in Juba allocated ministries for a proposed transitional government of national unity. The South Sudan government got 16 ministries and the rebels got 10. Foreign affairs was given to a group of former political detainees not aligned with either the South Sudan government or the rebels. Ezekiel Logat-Kuof, Secretary for Foreign Affairs of the rebels, says the rebels are satisfied with the deal, even if it doesn't meet all their demands.
We have reached a power-sharing deal. We have divided the ministries. The government of the Republic of South Sudan will take 16 ministries. The SPLM, SPLA in opposition will take 16. The former detainees will take 2. And the other political parties will take 2. So this is actually a serious breakthrough. And also we have submitted the list of our member of parliament, 50 of them, and we have submitted them to the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission. So this is a serious breakthrough. And we congratulated the people of South Sudan for waiting. And now, finally, they will have a government in place soon.
Ezekiel, as you said, the government of South Sudan, headed by President Salva Kiir, has 16 of the ministries. And you, the SPLA in opposition,
yes,
you have 10 of the ministries. You satisfied with what you have?
Well, we cannot say that we are satisfied with what we have. But this is an agreement that we have signed on to. Our chairman, Dr. Riek Machar, signed on to it. And then anything that we have signed on to, even if it is not satisfying what we wanted, we must implement it as it is. So we are happy with the ministries that we have selected, starting with the Ministry of Interior, Ministry of Petroleum, and Ministry of Higher Education, Science and Technology, Ministry of Energy and Dams, Ministry of Irrigation and Water Technology, Ministry of Humanitarian Affairs. All these 10 ministries, we are very happy with them because we want to deliver service to our people. And these ministries are basically targeting the needs of our people.
Although, as you said, this is a major development, as you know, there are still unaddressed issues. Am I right?
This is actually a win-win situation. Now the big task is who will fill those ministries so that service can be delivered to the people of South Sudan.
So who makes that decision in terms of who fills the ministries that the SPLA in opposition selected?
Well, we have our chairman, Dr. Riek Machar, and he has the leadership with him. They will sit and decide who should be deployed. So the SPLM in opposition will sit and decide who to deploy, and also the government will sit and decide who to deploy into the government. And then from there, the government will be based on the nominees of each party.
It's quite interesting. The former political prisoners were given the foreign ministry. Why do you think that happened?
Well, it is also in the spirit of creating a government of national unity. All the key ministries must be divided to all of us, and all the parties must be happy with what they get. So basically, it is a win-win situation, and we wanted to make sure that all of us, we are represented, are South Sudanese, and we have to have that spirit of uniting our people and our citizens so that we deliver service to them, and also we reconcile and heal the wounds that we have inflicted to ourselves.
So, Ezekiel, when will we have a transitional government where your leader, Dr. Riek Machar, and the South Sudan president will finally come and take their positions?
According to the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission timetable, the government of national unity should be in place by the 22nd of January 2016, whereby my chairman, Dr. Riek Machar Teng Durgun, will now assume his responsibility as the first vice president of the Republic of South Sudan.
Ezekiel Gatkouf is the Secretary for Foreign Affairs of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition. He was speaking with me from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. The Interreligious Council of Uganda has called for an independent investigation into allegations that the voter list to be used for the February 18 general election is not credible because it has been tampered with to benefit incumbent President Yoweri Museveni and his ruling National Resistance Movement. The council made the call after former Prime Minister Patrick Amama Mbabazi, who is also an independent presidential candidate, alleged that police and the soldiers have teamed up to alter the voter list. Joshua Kitakule, General Secretary of the Council, tells reporter Peter Clotty there's the need for calm and dialogue between the government, opposition groups, and other stakeholders in a bid to ease tension ahead of next month's elections.
We are calling upon the police and the Electoral Commission to investigate those allegations thoroughly, to ensure that we have a credible elections, because if that is not done, then great suspicion, and it can easily lead to mistrust, and then that can turn into violence. So our call is for thorough investigation, and the report should be published quickly so that the Ugandans are able to know the truth.
Opposition groups have said that the police have not been impartial in their enforcement of the law as mandated by the Constitution, and that they appear to have taken sides and usually appear to undermine the campaigns of the opposition by violently suppressing some of their campaign activities. What is your reaction to some of these complaints?
As the Interreligious Council of Uganda, we have called for dialogue between the opposition and the government, and we are very much aware that the Prime Minister, the Right Honorable Dr. Kakana Rugunda, has been meeting with the head of the opposition in Parliament, Honorable Philip Ogutu, and with the Shadow Attorney General and the Attorney General of Uganda to discuss some of the contentious issues in the law, and they have made a lot of progress as far as we are concerned, and we think that this is the way to go, dialogue. And I want to call upon all Ugandans and all institutions that are responsible for elections to play by the rules of the game, but also to exercise restraint and to avoid provocation. That's the only way we can have a peaceful and non-violent free elections.
Now, Mr. Kitakule, will the interreligious group, your group, hold meetings with the inter-party advisory committee or inter-party advisory group to make sure that you interact with them to as a principle to help ease tension ahead of the elections, because it appears there is too much tension among supporters of the main political parties ahead of the election?
We have been meeting with the members of the opposition. We've been engaged in a dialogue at various levels with the police, members of the opposition, with the ruling political party, to ensure that we, all of us, are working for a peaceful and violent-free elections. And I think the elections have been, by and large, peaceful.
Joshua Kitakule is the General Secretary of the Interreligious Council of Uganda. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Kampala. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, January 8th. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. A suicide truck bomb in Libya has killed 50 people. police recruits at a college close to the city of Misrata. No one has claimed responsibility. As Henry Richwell reports, the attack comes as the Islamic State terror group continues its assault on oil facilities in the east of the country.
Around 400 mostly young police recruits had gathered Thursday at a training college in the town of Zlitin when the suicide attacker struck. One of the policemen described what happened. He said the attacker drove through the gate very fast in a large truck and then the bomb exploded. Local residents helped ferry victims to hospitals in nearby Misrata. It is Libya's deadliest bomb attack since the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. Such attacks have become more frequent in recent months. Islamic State militants claimed Thursday to have captured the strategic coastal town of Bin Jawad. But risk analyst Riccardo Fabiani of the Eurasia Group argues the group's expansion in Libya has been limited.
The problem for IS in Libya is that they cannot really exploit religious, sectarian, let's say, divisions as they have.
In recent days, IS militants have launched attacks on major oil facilities in Es Sider and Ras Lanuf, resulting in huge fires.
Their strategy here is to attack these facilities, damage them. Why they're doing this right now, it's quite clear, because there is a peace deal, there is a national...
Libya's rival administrations, one based in Tripoli, backed by Islamist groups, and the other internationally recognised government in Tobruk, signed a UN-negotiated power-sharing deal last month, but they are yet to form a unity government. The UN envoy to Libya, Martin Kobler, is calling for Libyans to back the deal and unite against terrorism. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
A few days before Christmas, Al-Shabaab militants ambushed a bus traveling in northeastern Kenya near the Somalia border. The gunmen demanded the passengers divide themselves between Christians and Muslims. The passengers refused, and the militants eventually let the bus go. One of the passengers who was shot during the ordeal is still receiving treatment at Nairobi's Kenyatta National Hospital. Joel Craig visited the hospital and spoke with him about the events of that day.
Salah Sabdo Farah, a 34-year-old teacher and deputy headmaster at a northeastern Kenya primary school, was headed home to the town of Mandera after completing a training program in Masai Mara, located in the southwestern part of the country. Farah started his journey on December 20th. The next day, not far from Mandera, Al-Shabaab gunmen ambushed the bus in which he was traveling.
So when we reached somewhere at Kutulo, unfortunately, there was no escort. So we went, we bypassed the Kutulo, and then unfortunately we were surrounded by the Al-Shabaab.
After shooting at the bus, the militants demanded passengers disembark and divide themselves by religion.
Then we were told to get down. We refused. When we refused, they started shooting. So starting that time, when they started shooting, we went down. Everybody went down in panic. We went down, then we were talking to somewhere in a field. We were told to separate the Christian side, Muslim side. In the process of people now moving, we already given the girls some hijab Muslims, the attire for the Muslim girls. So we give them.
In giving headscarves to Christian women on the bus, passengers no doubt remembered a similar attack a year earlier, in which Al-Shabaab gunmen killed 28 non-Muslims traveling by bus from Mandera to Nairobi. Along with his fellow passengers, Farah had had enough. They refused the orders.
And then... at that moment, now when we are told to separate, we refused. That's the time that the bullet got to me from somewhere far. So it hit me at the hip.
When the ordeal was over, he was taken to Mandera Hospital before being flown to Nairobi for more intensive medical care. Farah says that Islam is a religion of peace and Muslims and Christians are neighbors.
People should live peacefully together. We are brothers. It's only that the religion is the difference. So I ask my brother Muslims to take care of the Christians so that the Christians also take care of us. And let us help one another and live together peacefully.
Another gunshot victim is also recuperating at Kenyatta National Hospital in Nairobi. Two others were killed. On Wednesday, police released the names of four suspects in the attack, appealing to the public for help and offering a reward for information leading to their arrests. As for Farah, he says he has taken comfort in all the good wishes he has received during his hospital stay. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Doctors Without Borders recently started a trauma surgery unit at its hospital in the northwestern Nigerian town of Maiduguri. The group says the purpose of the unit is to treat victims of recent attacks by ex-Boko Haram fighters who are now calling themselves the Islamic State's West Africa province. The MSF medical team leader in Maiduguri, Ahmed Mohammed Mahat, tells Ricky Stryak the growing number of internally displaced persons arriving in the Borno state capital mean there are increasing medical needs in the area that MSF is working to fill.
So Umaru Shehu Actual Modern Hospital is located 10 kilometers away from the heart of the city of Maiduguri.
And you guys have recently started trauma surgery at this hospital, is that correct?
Correct. We are doing trauma surgery at the moment in that facility. We are supporting.
Because this just started recently, this trauma surgery. Did you see a need, and where is that need coming from?
Because previously there is one trauma center supported by ICRC in the State Specialist Hospital. We have seen that it is serving one part of the city, and then we wanted to decrease the congestion in that hospital. So we opened up the service in Umaru Shehu to cover the needs of the other city, other part of the city.
What are those needs?
So we received 40 patients at Marusha in our accident and emergency unit on 27th around 9:40 p.m. And then among them, 16, we discharged 12 of them because they had minor injuries. We admitted 24 patients to our the surgical department. We operated on 13 patients at the moment.
And that was due to a specific attack on the 27th of December.
On 27th, there was an attack in the city, so we'll not comment on that. But we received 40 patients in regards to related to bomb blast.
Have you had any more trauma surgery patients since then?
Previous, there was. But this is recently, this is the high number of patients we received in our department.
Do you think this is a population that, outside of people like MSF and ICRC, it's underserved in terms of the medical needs, especially urgent medical needs?
Previously, there was a high urgent, you know, there was an increased urgent need in the camp. Now the camps are now becoming stabilized. So we are still, there's still people moving in. There are more IDPs moving into Maiduguri from Adamawa State and from other liberated areas into Maiduguri at the moment. So still there is still need, and we are working on it to make sure that we will help in whichever way possible.
MSF has said that on the 28th of December, when you received all these cases, there were actually quite a number of children who were injured.
That's correct. We received 16 of them under 15 years.
Right now, are you seeing that the need is increasing for medical care in Maiduguri, or is it decreasing?
With the increase in number of IDPs, with the movement of IDPs into Maiduguri at the moment, nowadays it is increasing on daily basis, coming from Adamawa states and also from other liberated areas. There's still need for us to be here, and in some of the camps, they still need some interventions. So we'll try as much as possible to get involved in areas that need our attention.
That was Ahmed Mohammed Mahat, medical team leader for Doctors Without Borders. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Maiduguri, Nigeria. Having endured over a decade of hardship as a result of an unrelenting economic crisis, Zimbabweans have developed a reputation of not just being resilient, but also innovative in how to get by. Sports betting has become one of the increasingly popular ways of earning a living for many people in the country. Taraya Shava of your Zimbabwe service reports from Harare.
About half a dozen men huddle together as they listen attentively to a horse racing commentary being broadcast on one of the big screen television sets in a popular betting place at Gweru's Mkoba 6 shopping center in the Midlands province. Among them is a man who chooses to identify himself only as Moyo and is one of the well-known regulars at this place. Moyo, in his early 40s, readily volunteers to talk about his experience as a horse racing punter. He says he detests betting as he believes it is immoral and reveals that he grew up with a father who used to squander most of his wages on gambling, which made him fail to take care of his family. But in an ironic twist of fate, Moyo admits he himself became drawn to betting on horses, which has been his regular source of income since the time he got out of formal employment in 1998.
When I was an adult, so when I was already working, I would see people making money from gambling. When I started betting, I had a dream. I dreamt a race and its results. And then the following day, I went and betted. And the numbers just came as they appeared in my dream. Then I started believing. I know this thing, I could make money and earn a living. Though I was working, because I had got a surplus amount.
Although it is often associated with gambling, sports betting is different in that it is regularized or controlled by law, while various forms of gambling are sometimes illegal. In Zimbabwe, the Gaming and Lotteries Act regulates the sports betting industry as well as other betting games like lotteries and casinos. Horse racing has for a long time been the only sport in the country on which punters could place bets, but in the past few years, several betting companies have been given licenses to operate bets on other sports like soccer, basketball, cricket, tennis, as well as dog racing. Reporting from Gweru, this is Taurai Shava.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Gabonese striker Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang was crowned the 2015 Africa Football of the Year at the GLO Confederation of African Football Awards ceremony in Abuja, Nigeria on Thursday. Cameroon's Gaëlle Nganamowit is the Africa Female Footballer of the Year. Tanzanian Bwana Ali Samata scooped the Player of the Year based in Africa accolade, while Frenchman Harvey Renard is Coach of the Year. Nigerian striker Victor Osimhen is Young Player of the Year. His teammate Ogenekaro Etebo bagged the Most Promising Talent of the Year award. African champions Ivory Coast are the National Men's Team of the Year, while Cameroon are the National Female Team Award winners. The Democratic Republic of Congo's TP Mazembe was named the Club of the Year. Ghanaian Charles Giamfi was conferred the Legends Award posthumously. Cameroon's Samuel Mbappe also received the Legends Award. Somalia's Abdi Kwani Said Arab was named Football Administrator of the Year. Senegal's Football Supporters Club Alaise Kassa bagged the Fair Play Award. Gambian Bakari Gassama was crowned Referee of the Year for the second year in a row, while the Nigerian Head of State Muhammadu Buhari received the Platinum Award. Meanwhile, hosts Uganda play Gabon in Injeru, some 80 kilometers east of the capital Kampala, in a friendly match on Sunday. Rwanda hosts the Democratic Republic of Congo in Gisenyi. Elsewhere in South Africa, Angola face Guinea in Johannesburg as Nigeria engage Ivory Coast in the capital Tshwane. These are build-up matches ahead of the African Nations Championships starting in Kigali, Rwanda next week. Finally, in tennis, the Africa Junior Championship West and Central Africa Zonal Qualifiers gets underway in Abuja, Nigeria tomorrow, Saturday. Players from Benin, Burkina Faso, Gabon, Ghana, Ivory Coast, Mali, Sierra Leone, Togo, and host Nigeria are vying for slots to the Africa Junior Tennis Championship due in South Africa next year. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend. We'll see you again on Monday morning. And that's it for this Friday, January 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ouma, along with our engineer John Ellison, I'm James Bate, wishing all of you in Africa a very good weekend.
Next on Let's Talk. Aging. Are you ready for it? Are you saving enough money for it? Join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing aging. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.